You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Matthew Bodie, who's going to be talking to us about something that I think is very important for people to be knowing about, to be aware of. Matthew Bodie has written for many publications and authored three books. He's appeared on CNN and MSNBC and in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other media outlets. He's been a leader in faculty organizing since 2020 as president of the Georgia Conference of the American Association of University Professors, a national higher education advocacy group. He completed his PhD in English in 2015 at the University of South Carolina, where he also received, in 2010, a master's in creative writing. He most prizes his bachelor's degree in journalism in 2001 from the University of Florida and his work at the campus newspaper, The Independent Florida Alligator. He is a full professor of rhetoric at the University of North Georgia. He researches and writes about religious rhetoric, particularly in the last few years, about the rise of Christian nationalism. His new book is The Seven Mountains Mandate, Exposing the Dangerous Plan to Christianize America and Destroy Democracy. And the book description says that it is about exposing the decades-long plan to radically transform America, how the Seven Mountains Movement, prosperity preachers, and political operatives are destroying democracy under Trump's second administration. The movement to install a populist strongman in the White House with a game plan for enforcing right-wing policies and catering to evangelical Christians started well before Donald Trump's presidency. For decades, a well-funded network of religious and political operatives has been quietly working to dismantle democracy and replace it with Christian theocracy. Their strategy? The Seven Mountains Mandate, a plan to seize control of seven key pillars of American society that reshape the nation, which we will talk more about. I want to welcome Matthew onto the show today to share very important information with us. Here's Matthew now. Today on the show, we have Matthew Bode, who I'm very excited to talk to. The work that you are doing, what you're exploring, what you're trying to help people understand is very timely and is disturbing and seems all-encompassing and is one of these things that you've put either a light on in the dark or a magnifier over something that has been hidden and has been diminished, I think, in certain people's minds, but really needs to be explored, expanded on, looked at to see how far-reaching it is so that people know that there is this undercurrent, there's this force, there is this determined stance to keep something going and to have it be broadened while we're just sitting and doing our thing, going to work, having our breakfast. There are people who are very busy trying to create a different world for us to live in. And so it is so good that you're here to explain it to us today and help us see what maybe we haven't been seeing, but we do need to see. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
So I'd love you to take a moment to introduce yourself, let people know about you, and we'll also be talking about the book that has come out and is really wonderful and incredibly well researched. You did a deep dive and it's really, really important. So tell us about you.
I'm a professor of English with an emphasis in rhetoric and composition, which tends to be about the study of words, but really could be about the study of anything. And I happen to study religious rhetoric. I'm in Georgia. I'm at the University of North Georgia. But also, I would say that I've been following the group in this book, Turning Point, for several years now, and really focusing on what it is they do, both at the college and high school level, but in all ages. And lastly, I think the most important biographical point that your listeners need is I grew up an evangelical. I wouldn't use that term to describe myself now, but I understand the cultural conservatives, the social conservatives, the political conservative world. But also you add in this theological element that I understood for a long time. So when Charlie Kirk picked it up, I knew what they were getting at very quickly.
Oh, it's so interesting. A lot of us who are trying to become more and more aware are still going to be blindsided by what's happening. I'd like you to first start by talking about what rhetoric is, what religious rhetoric is as well. We've talked a little bit about it on the show, but we also talk about, and I talk about, the use of language, how language is so forceful in terms of being able to manipulate and to shift how things are seen or to make sure certain things are hidden as well. Or that it evokes a certain feeling, or it makes sure to not evoke a feeling so that people don't get concerned about something that they should get concerned about. And it's very specific and really powerful. So talk to us about what religious rhetoric is and also your interest in exploring it.
Rhetoric is about framing things. It is about putting things into context, but it is also about understanding language in a particular way. And that particular way is that language is alive, first of all, and it's not a static, you know, go to the dictionary and pick out the right word kind of thing. But that when we use language or any type of words, we're really just focusing on a particular aspect of reality. We want words or use words, we name things, if you will, so that we could, in some manners, force, manipulate, but not everybody's trying to force. The idea is that we're choosing labels to have people focus on things that we want them to focus on. So rhetoric is about the persuasion of that. Some people think it is about persuasion of opinions or changing people's minds, and it's certainly about that. But really down at the word level, it is about having people pay attention to something that perhaps they were not paying attention to before. And of course, mentioning or missing out on not paying attention to other things. So you think about religious rhetoric, I always go back to the Gospel of John and the word came to us. That word there is the Greek logos. And a lot of people think about that as, again, the quintessential word or that Jesus is the logos. But it shows that to me, when we use words, when we talk to people, we're doing it in a way that dates back to Jesus, but also that we can use them both good and bad. I wrote a book about the rhetoric of evil several years ago. And the idea was that we have this word evil, and sometimes we use it as the end of the conversation. It's evil, and that's we can't say much more about it. And of course, when we see the word evil used, we often think about people that are outside of humanity. So my book was argued, no, that evil is part of our humanity, and it's particularly in our language. The line between good and evil runs through our language. Not that so much we choose to use words in a good way or an evil way, but because after the fall, our language is so tied up in sin or so tied up in evil, we don't often notice that we're using things in a bad way, or there's a mixture of two. If I could say that religious rhetoric is the study of that, how people use words, whether they use those divine terms, and I don't just mean terms about God, divine in terms of all-powerful words, like evil in a negative sense, but crazy as the president used it last night. There's no other word that goes beyond that. We ratchet up the stakes of our words often, sometimes in arguments. We keep adding up to all-encompassing words like all the time or things like that. But I think the study of religious rhetoric gets at not just how we talk about God or how we talk about evil, but how we understand the religious nature of words. And I don't just mean spiritual words, but the way in which they're alive and that they can mean different things to different people, but that constantly change and we have to settle on or agree upon or have this common notion of particular words. And sometimes they change over time. The definition of evil has changed over time, if you want to say that. That was part.
How has it changed over time?
The case studies that I did are different moments in history about the use of the word evil. So I started back with the Genesis use of the word, and particularly how Dietrich Bonhoeffer read The Fall of Man. And it became not so much an individual, internal thing, it became a social thing. And so I started looking at how ancient rhetoricians or ancient people who studied rhetoric, a guy named Isocrates, used the word evil. He noticed that many people in his time were using the word evil, their version of it, to talk about lower class of people, the hoi polloi, people who did not have the spirit or arete or the classical Greece character. He said, well, that's interesting. So he switched it to people who were corrupt, people who used words badly, who told you the same speech again and again as leaders and didn't do anything. So you can see we can use it in different ways. And then I moved to World War II and 9/11. And World War II, of course, it became this kind of extra human thing. They did these evil things. Sometimes we lose the idea that the people that did the bad things during World War II were human. And then when 9/11 comes, we have this axis of evil, this national evil, if you will, this group evil, this dark evil. And I think that's where evil has kind of ended up. It's this dark figure. There's no specifics on it, but you can often use it very easily on groups of people. And once you do that, there's no questioning it because you don't want to question the big word.
When I work with people who have been manipulated, people who have been in cultic groups, people who have been sometimes in abusive relationships, they'll make blanket statements that they think are factual because they've been told something about the world. It is this, or I am this, or this is what's wrong with me. People who are being kept from their families are taught that their families are the ones trying to control them, even though their families are the ones trying to rescue them. Very often, like when I work with people who have been involved in relationships with narcissists, they can sometimes tell the nature of the narcissist by what they're accused of doing. They themselves, they're called abusive and they're called controlling and they're called a lot of things to call off the dog, so to speak. Language finds its way to make things cloudy at times and make things difficult to really notice as they are. I think about Robert J. Lifton and his teachings about thought terminating cliches, that we learn just to say certain things and then we can stop having cognitive dissonance. Like somehow it explains it all. But does it? Sometimes people don't want the messiness of wondering, well, does it really? Is this really the answer? Does this make sense? And so I'm just wondering, before we get into more about your book, what do you think it is about people that makes them drawn to just accepting rhetoric without getting into the, but I wonder ifs?
I think two things. One, Hannah Arendt, her writings about the World War II era, talked about thinking. Thinking happens when you stop, that you have to stop and think. That thoughtlessness happens when you continue on with ways in which you were using words, or you say thinking at that point, but you say it's really kind of cliche thinking. The reason that people are drawn into high control groups or cults or religious organizations is that they offer a tremendous worldview or big picture or ways to understand everything else that is happening. They do that with big, huge words, and they put them in a hierarchical fashion with God at the top and some other ones, and they repeat that again and again. And then they add, of course, the, if you question this, you're not just distrusting me, but you're distrusting God. If you don't read your sacred text in a particular manner, if you think that this word can change definition over time, then you're questioning the entire system. That is the practice of believing or practice of reading the day-to-day prayer life is connected to this larger thing. And so when you hear that again and again, when you think, oh, I'm going to question this one thing, but no, you're actually questioning everything. And that really is a tough move for people to make. So when you start to see that you're questioning everything, do you really want to go that far? And if you think about cults and things like that, but in day-to-day lives, right, we constantly have our attention span shortened and pay attention to things that are mundane or TV shows because we don't want to pay attention to the other things. So we're doing the same thing, just perhaps not religiously.
Something that I've talked about on this podcast before is the translations and mistranslations of things that originated in other languages or in ancient languages, how a certain translation has guided our way of looking at things, but does it really mean that? Or was that just a mistranslation by accident? Or was it a mistranslation on purpose? I always think that that's very interesting. There's been a lot of talk about mistranslations being the source of a lot of fundamental bias against certain genders or certain ways of living. And is it really evil? Is it wrong? Is it less than? Or is that just the way it was seen? And so it is good to go to the origin if you can, but it's hard to find the origin sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, the problem of translation, of course, is that everybody thinks it's kind of a one-to-one thing. I just find the English word for this Greek word or whatever, but it's hardly that. If you think about the word itself, what does it contain? Definitions, pictures, connotations, but there's always things on the outside of it that we have now then agreed to cut off. And when you don't agree to cut it off, then you get into a lot of different problems.
Absolutely right. And your work with investigating crime, let's talk about that, because I feel like you getting into noticing the whodunits.
Well, yeah, I'm not a detective. So many years ago, yes, I was a crime reporter. I have a degree in journalism from the University of Florida for, oh, it's 25 years ago now. So started off with that. And I think really two things. One, that has stayed with me, that type of writing for the public, but also interested in people and narratives. If you do that for too long, I have seen stories of people, if you cover negative things too long. And to be honest with you, the second thing is I still remember some of those stories, and my wife acts about them every now and then. It's like I can still recall those things because they were so terrible. So they fitted into my memory. Crime reporting is, of course, going to the courthouse and going to the sheriff's office and going to the jail, but it also is about writing about the terrible traffic accident on the interstate. But I think also it is about not so much trying to solve the case, but keep cold cases in the public eye.
It's interesting where our interests take us and what we learn when we're doing that, and then how we bring it into what we're doing next, which I think it's great to talk to someone who's done a lot of different things and has studied a lot of different things, because I think it does broaden your scope and the way you look at everything.
It certainly has affected my academic life. I don't necessarily think myself as an academic or writing like an academic or writing these theoretical academic stuff. I try to write like a journalist, and that often gets rejected by academic publishers.
It's so interesting. I'm now writing a book and the editor keeps saying, expand that thought. I'm used to being the interviewer. I'm not used to expanding on a thought, or I'll ask the question with a client and have them be the one to do most of the talking. So I have to learn how to talk more, how to write for longer. It's not necessarily in my nature. So let's move into the Seven Mountains Mandate. If you can talk about what those are and where we are now in this process. There was someone who came on the podcast about a year ago who talked a bit about it. What I'm concerned about, which is probably the case, is that a lot has happened since then that we need to know about, and that it's moving and shaking, and that there's a lot of distraction from seeing what it is. I don't know about people's politics as they're listening to this, and I'll probably hear something about this, but there are so many distractions, and sometimes purposeful ones, to keep us from seeing what's happening and how the world is changing, and that there are movements that are being created and expanded upon that are going to be impacting us if they haven't already started. They probably have already started. And it reminds me of something that I saw by a political cartoonist who said, there's a conversation in this cartoon. One person says to the other one, do you realize how big Greenland is? And the other person says, yeah, I heard it's 98% of the space that can take over or that can cover up the Epstein files. And I thought, that's one way of looking at it. Let's just set a fire here, set a fire there, set a fire here, set a fire there. And is that going to keep us from seeing what we need to see? So this is not a political statement as much. It is a statement about how we can get distracted. What are your thoughts about that?
So the Seven Mountains Mandate is a strategy of Christian nationalism, of the term your listeners know, but basically the idea to Christianize America, Christianize in particular conservative, usually whites. So Christian nationalism, of course, is to make America a Christian nation, and they also believe that America was founded as a Christian nation, and somewhere along the lines, we lost that. It's unclear when that happens over time, but mainly they go back to the 60s and say we've lost our culture at that point. And really, the seven mountains are metaphors for the seven areas of our culture. And I always leave one off the list when I do the list. So I'm just going to read them from the book. The book is, each chapter is about one area of our culture. So the mountain of education, the mountain of government, the mountain of religion, the mountain of family, the mountain of business, the mountain of media, and the mountain of entertainment. These mountains are thought of by Christian nationalism supporters as areas of our culture that are controlled by demonic forces, satanic forces, anti-Christian forces. Over the years, our secular culture has kicked out Jesus from the public square. The mountain metaphor means that these people are supposed to climb the mountain and retake the high places of these mountains, to retake our culture. It should be seen not just as a political thing, because obviously one of the mountains is the mountain of government, but it is a wider aspect than that. To retake our entire culture does not just mean to win the government. We talk about Project 2025, and that was a very large set of policies going to be or already put into place by the president if he won election. But it was about one mountain. In many ways, Project 2025 is one of the seven mountains. The Seven Mountains Mandate is an idea that we should retake our culture for Jesus, and that we've lost that culture over time. And I want to point out not just the cultural part of it, but the institutional part of it. As an evangelical person who grew up evangelical, when we think about culture, we do agree at some point that Christians don't control the culture, that it's an anti-Christian culture, whatever word you want to use there. But mainly evangelicals and people who believe that in the last few decades have said, okay, well, then we're going to create our own culture. We're going to have Christian media. We're going to have Christian music. We're going to have Christian values of the family. And we're going to spread those within our areas. And we're going to spread the gospel wide and far, but we're going to separate ourselves in many ways from culture. And individually, people do that. People make individual choices to send their kid to private school or homeschoolers, things like that. But the Seven Mountains Mandate kind of turns that on its head. and says, no, obviously you should not separate from culture. But it is not just an individual spreading the gospel that's going to save America. It is institutional retaking. So they work at the institutional level instead of the individual level. They're still interested in spreading the gospel, and they're still interested in spreading their religion, but they're not interested primarily in doing it through conversion. The Seven Mountains Mandate is a minority movement on purpose. I say minority. There's a segment of the population that is very small that believes this, and also believes that they can win the culture not by mass conversion, not by converting the majority of people to Christian, and therefore we have a Christian culture. What they think Christian culture should look like is there are individual people, perhaps groups of people, that are over these areas of culture, that run these areas of culture, and then will influence down the mountain to the culture. It may not be a majority Christian country in terms of adherence to it. A consensus Christian culture is what they're after. And they want these seven areas to reflect their version of religion. Of course, mountain religion being one of them. So I would mention that at the institutional level. And so just go to the mountain of religion, for example. You think, well, the church, Christians already run the church. They start at that mountain and suggest, of course, the church has not done enough to take back the culture. The Christians in the pews have not really acted in a way in which to show that they're interested in winning the culture war. So to activate them and motivate them and things like that. But really it is to make the church the center of culture, to make its rulers, its leaders, part of judging the culture. And in many ways, we'll say the church as akin to a city council and passing laws and stuff, but also that kind of ruling board of elders, if you will. So this strategy of Christian nationalism is bread and butter of conservative evangelicals, but also the Republican Party. There are polls and surveys that show up to 30 to 40% of Americans would agree with this mandate. Of course, that number is higher when you ask just Republicans or conservatives. And you can see why it's taken a hold, because it allows those people to not just be passive in terms of accepting the culture war, but it allows them to fight back. And this brings us obviously to the president in the last year. He had a first term and now he has a second term. And both of those elections were powered by white evangelicals who follow this mandate, particularly charismatic Christians. A lot of his evangelical advisory boards are in that category. And that is the origins of the mandate. It's about 50 years old. In the 70s, this idea that we'd lost the culture in the 60s, and also that we were looking for ways to engage conservatives politically in America. The legend has it that Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade, and a guy named Laurie Cunningham, who founded a missionary group called Youth with a Mission, met in August of 75 in Colorado, and each claimed a divine inspiration for these seven areas. They literally exchanged their list together and said, oh, look, you had the same list. And that God was telling them we need to retake or influence these areas for culture. At the same time, so Schaeffer was touring America and coming back over from Switzerland and doing his thing. And he was talking about culture and he was talking about taking over the arts and doing Christian arts and taking back politics. And so he was doing similar things, not just with a list perhaps. And so those three people are kind of known as the forefathers of this movement. It has different names along the way in its 50-year history. Christian nationalism and the Seven Mountains Mandate come later. People might recognize Christian dominionism or theocracy in the 70s and 80s with a guy named R.J. Rush Juni. So it's known by different things, and changing the names changes a little bit. But the idea, of course, is that there should be a forceful, perhaps, domination of Christians of their culture, whether or not they are in the majority or not. Some people might begin it with government, begin it with laws, but the phrase that most of the people in this mandate movement use is that reformation comes before revival. Forming the country's institutions, reforming the country's laws, reforming the country's culture would then bring revival. Whereas, as I kind of described before, most evangelicals would say, revival happens. People get saved, come to Jesus, and they change the culture. The Seven Mountains Mandate turns that on its head. So through the years, it's been spread through different people in different ways, but it's mainly been connected to President Trump because a guy named Lance Wallnau, who is on the second generation of these people, became famous for making the mountain metaphor. And how he did that's a long story, but the idea was he said he had this dream from God that showed him a bunch of mountains, and that he specifically got the list from Laurie Cunningham back in 2000-2001. Lance Wannell writes several books about Trump and how Trump is the King Cyrus or the different biblical figures. and that he's supposed to implement the Seven Mountains mandate. And it kind of did that in the first term, but in the second term, it is full on. You can see the Seven Mountains mandate as a cultural change, as a cultural consensus, as an authoritarian culture. Authoritarians don't just want to control the government, they want to control everything else. So it is about imposing their culture over the rest of us. And the last thing I'll say in terms of like the strategy or the idea, it is one particular type of religion. So where religious liberty or religious freedom work itself out there, it's kind of unclear. As a consensus Christian culture, what type of Christians are we talking about? Do we include all Protestants and all Catholics? And then what do we do with the people that are not that? How much do they get to practice that, or how much do they get to influence culture by practicing their religion? People talk about theocracy or Christian nationalism or a Christian nation. That's generally what they're talking about, the Seven Mountains mandate, even though they may not use that phrase.
So there's so much to talk about here. And I noticed already in our use of certain rhetoric that we've gotten used to hearing, when you were talking about this idea that somehow secularism is akin to evil, or being secular somehow means being anti-Christian.
Godless, yeah.
Secular is just secular. It's not saying anything about anything else.
Well, they would not see it as a neutral term. If you think about the Mountain of Education, for example, the move to take your kids out of public schools because public schools are evil or secular, and go put them in a private school or homeschool. Okay, that was the decades-long move by evangelicals. Now the Seven Mountains mandate wants to go back into these public schools and make them patriotic and make them civic-based and to teach them patriotism that's based in Christian nationalism. So you can see the ways in which they do both at the same time. Secularism is bad. We don't want secularism, but you can't have your own secularism because we have to take it from you because it's bad.
So even the word patriot or patriotic, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's not going to say any of the things that we were just talking about. It doesn't mean Christian. It doesn't mean Republican. It doesn't mean conservative. It doesn't mean a lot of things. It's just being rah-rah your country.
So there's a different tie, yeah. That's not reclaiming these words, but using these words for their own ends, taking ownership of these words, if you want to say it that way. That the only way to be a patriot is this way. The reason that they latch on to American patriotism as their rhetorical means is a lot of the stuff that they're going to say is going to be highly negative. If we think about preachers and pastors talking about Christian nationalism, they don't use that term for themselves. They talk about patriotism because you can be patriotic and go along with them without noticing that you're doing that or noticing that you're becoming a Christian nationalist or who hates their country. It's kind of the fait accompli. How could you hate your country?
I'm wondering also, just going back to something you said, and then we'll move forward, but you were talking about this idea of people are saying that they're founded as a Christian nation. So there are a lot of people who would disagree with that, probably also including the founding fathers. People will sometimes say to me, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say if someone says, well, but this was founded as a Christian nation. They don't have enough information to be able to say, no, it wasn't necessarily, and it was founded on all these other things. And freedom of religion, etc. And I wonder two things. One is it possible to help people know how to respond to that in a factual way? And also, is it worth it? Are you talking to someone who has already decided something, and so it's not worth sparring about it? What do you think?
I do find sometimes it is not worth it. But for the people that want to respond to the historical claim that we were founded as a Christian nation, usually the people that say that say something along the lines of 55 or the 56 signers of the Declaration or the whatevers were Bible-believing Christians. One, they didn't all believe in the same Bible. They weren't all a particular sect of Protestantism. And of course, there were people that there were not. But also, I think that with the First Amendment being the separation of church and state, they certainly believed in the church. And there are many churches, and we can talk about that. But they believed specifically that the state should not have a national religion because they were fighting England, who did have a national religion and did have a king that was connected to the church. So if your simple definition of a Christian nation is that it has a national religion, we were not given one. There were lots of Christians in the original colonies, lots of people that were not. And so if you think about, is it majority people who are conversion, or is it some sort of state religion? I don't think it's either. But on the question of whether or not you should try, people that say that often then jump to, we are not one today. So they're implying, of course, that they want one. I think you should ask them what it is that they want today. If what they wanted happened back in the past and it's not happening today, what is it that they want? Do they want the majority of people to be converted? Okay, let's do that. Let's spread the gospel. Let's pay missionaries and do that. But if it's this other thing, this, I don't like what other people do with their culture, or I don't like this and that, I don't know where you go with that.
Because I think people don't feel equipped with enough information to rebut. And sometimes that doesn't get you very far anyway. But thank you for responding, because I think people do want to know if there are some facts that they can really hold to and educate someone on. Let's talk about the different mountains, because you mentioned one that I think would be good to expand on. And I also want to get to the education piece, because it really matters quite a bit to me and to a lot of other people. But the family mountain. So what is that?
You know, the thing about the seven mountains, there are different ways or methods that the people that had this idea go back and try to reclaim these mountains. Obviously, the mountain of government, you're electing people. The mountain of education, you're changing educational policies. The mountain of family is kind of vague in the sense of how they go about doing that. But what they do want is the Christian notion, traditional notion of family, supported, advocated for, to be the consensus notion in the nation. That means two things. One, obviously marriage between a man and a woman. And then two, that there are specific gender roles assigned to those two genders. And we see that very distinctly, clearly in the Secretary of War / Department of Defense, Pete Hegseth, that men should go out and protect the nation and women should stay home and protect the home. That doesn't mean the homeland, that means the literal home. Therefore, women don't serve in military roles. That men should be leaders across the culture, not just in the church. That men play a special role as protectors, both of their own families and of the nation. So you take that as their goal. So how do they go about and doing that? There's the positive declarations by Pete Hegseth and others of doing that. But really, what many of the groups in the Seven Mountains Mandate have done is take the fight to the groups that they disagree with. Instead of just allowing them to exist and fighting out in the public square, what they're now doing is trying to silence or ambush or shame those other people so they won't participate in our culture. So I tell the story of Turning Point USA in the Mountain of Family chapter, where they have, on their own, started an online chat with a person who thinks they're talking to an underage girl. And they continue to chat with this person so much that, you know, there's terrible things that are said, and then, hey, can we meet? And they construct this meeting to happen at a Walmart in Nebraska. This is in 2023. So this guy shows up to meet in the Walmart. And then he is, of course, not met by a young girl. He is met by the Turning Point USA crew. And they're going to film this ambush of them telling their audience what it is this person has said. And it goes very badly in a lot of different ways. But this idea is that we should not just turn this over to law enforcement. We should make this a cultural war. We should do this ourselves. We should protect the nation from these people. And Turning Point is not the only group that does this. This kind of fake conversations and then ambushing people to shame them on camera. There are many groups connected with Christian nationalism that do this. And that's just one example of a pretty extreme example. But the larger examples are getting people to not participate in our culture because of the way in which they live their lives. So not necessarily like getting them to vote or anything, but shaming them enough where they don't participate. So you think about the mountain of family and gender roles. So making fun of women, silencing them for dancing certain ways. The Taylor Swift argument comes up a lot in that one, that you compare her to people who don't do that thing. Or people who don't want to get married and have kids, that the definition of family is not just to get married and have kids, but to have a lot of them at a young age. I think also there's this pushing of the traditional wife, the trad wife thing, that is connected to the president as well. So there's a lot of different ways in which they try to change the culture, but they're not just trying to persuade people. They're going out and trying to silence and shame people and ambushing them in many ways to make them example.
Incredible. When we talk about what is focused upon in the news and refocused upon, we also see that there are certain parts of our population that are repeatedly shamed and that are called out as not only because I think about this for being Jewish and I think about so much anti-Semitic rhetoric is that somehow the Jews are running things or controlling things or ruining things. And I think about the whole thing with trans athletes. Somehow that became such a huge thing. And I think about the tiny percentage of the population, same with the Jewish population, not just 2%, 0.2%, the Jewish population. But still somehow everything bad is because of us. And I've had clients who have come out of cultic systems and we're talking and, you know, in a few minutes while they're waiting, let's say for their spouse to join or something, we just start chatting. A lot of them will start using these talking points, not knowing that they're talking points and that they sort of are regurgitating things that they heard. And part of the work that we're going to be doing together is how to undo the fact that they have imprinted information that was imprinted as fact because it was so often repeated. And they will say, oh, you believe all these trans athletes ruining it for everyone. I'm thinking, wait, what? That's the thing that really gets you. We're so susceptible to the repetition of things. And that's why I'm curious to talk about education and the messages we get early on. And I think about, I don't remember how old I was. Now, in retrospect, I'm thinking I was too old for this to not know. But I remember thinking there was this notion around Thanksgiving that, yes, it was true that the pilgrims sat with Native Americans and shared information and mutual respect. And these people were heroes and everyone got along. Those were the pictures and those were the drawings and those were all of the things that you learned.
Big hats and the turkeys and the table, yeah.
Right. And oh, and teach us, oh, wise Native Americans who have been here a lot longer than us. That's, no, we wish, because we would have a lot more information that was really good information to have. But I thought Christopher Columbus was a hero until a few years ago. Again, too late in my lifetime, not too late to find out information. But we want people to be heroes and we want people to be seen in certain lights. And it's hard to look at the reality of the situation at times. And I just wonder from what you know about how much this influence has already been a part of the school systems. It would be good for people to know, people who are sending their kids, especially to public schools. I don't know what you know about the level of infiltration without, I don't mean to sound paranoid in my talking about it.
I think the word indoctrination comes up a lot from these groups. And what that means to them, of course, is things they don't agree with. But the process of indoctrination, just generically, is this kind of repetition of things. Repetition of big, huge concepts that you don't get to question, that explain everything about you, your identity, your relationship to your family, your community, and therefore pulling a thread at either one of them makes it fall apart. But I also think indoctrination is a form of telling people what to think, but not teaching them how to think. So if you think about what the Seven Mountains Mandate, the basis of it is, right, that there's this mountain of education that is not just secularly neutral, it is not just without religion, that the public schools are indoctrinating children to believe that America is not the greatest country, that America was not founded as a destination, and also they're indoctrinating them in all the other six other mountain ways, mountain of family being one of them. And that the number of hours you spend in a school day versus the number of hours you have with your kids at home, it's totally imbalanced. You should take them out immediately. Over the years, I'm in my 40s, I've obviously heard arguments for homeschooling and private schooling. And there are different things for that. But each time I hear it, that the stakes have been raised so much that it is not just getting a better education. It is not just saving kids from a bad public school now with the voucher programs in all these states. Any student can go to any private school they want. They don't have to have a bad experience at a public school. You don't have to attend a public school in some states to get the voucher money to go to a private school. So it is not about saving particular schools. It is about changing the institution. On the going back in and then changing those schools, once you have over the years suggested that they're so bad, not just bad in test scores or bad in education, but bad morally, now you offer them the patriotic curriculum. And we see that, and of course, in second term of President Trump with the Department of Education, they're doing this tour about the 250th anniversary of America, and they're going to schools and talking about things that might be true in terms of our founding, but really this idea that patriotism is centered around loving the flag and loving your Bible. Turning Point USA, the biggest organization in the book, is a part of this 250th celebration. They've been to many of these stops with the Department of Education, and they are part of a large cadre of conservative groups who are going in and starting clubs in high schools. And, you know, it's mainly around the flag. It's mainly around patriotism, veterans. They're always interested in serving with veteran groups. But the more you stay with them, the more you get closer and closer to the turning point, Christian nationalism. In terms of rhetoric, it often becomes very hard to separate the Christian part from the patriot part. And if you do that over time, you indoctrinate people. So you think about what Turning Point could do at this point with a student. They join their Turning Point Club America group as a high school freshman and then graduate college 8 years later. That's 8 years worth of the same repetition of things, of the same bumper sticker mentality, of the same debates and talking points. If you want to call that indoctrination, fine. They have the time and the means and the method in which to give that person not just a worldview, but give that person ways in which to block out any other thing. If you think about indoctrination or cult-like practices, it's repetition, it's authority teaching, it is ways in which they use sacred texts. The sacred texts for these people are the Constitution and the Bible. And it's funny that some of the things I see online of like the ways in which they read the Constitution, the originalist message, it means this. That's the same way these people talk about the Bible. And so it is always kind of a gray line between the two.
What I'm also noticing is sometimes if you compare, let's say, the Constitution and the Bible, there are going to be some things that don't overlap, that don't gel well together. But there is, I think, through rhetoric, the ability to put the square peg in the round hole, like they'll make it fit. And so I'm just wondering where you've seen that. How are they going to explain this one away and make it seem like, oh, this is what our forefathers were talking about? What do you think? What have you noticed?
I think that one is a Bible verse that Charlie Kirk liked to use when he was talking about Christian nationalism. I always get the exact citation wrong, but it's in Jeremiah, that you should work for the prosperity of your city, because when your city prospers, then you prosper. And this is a verse about Jewish exiles and trying to suggest you're going to be here a while. And he changes the word city to nation on purpose. And no other Bible translation has the word nation instead of city there. And of course, they then try to suggest, of course, the nation of Israel means the same thing. But by changing the word from city to nation, you can easily then move from the biblical times into America times. You should seek the prosperity of your nation, because when the nation prospers, you prosper. You should seek the moral greatness or make America great again-ishness of your nation, because when that happens, you'll your nation. This goes along with President Trump's. When we become richer, we become stronger. The prosperity meaning something to do with money. You take the Bible verse that applies long ago to a group of people and then make it vague enough so that it fits, as you say, the square peg in the round hole today, and do a couple of hula hoops to get nation and things to mean the same thing. And now you have a connection to the people in the pew that this is a Christian nation, just like Israel was a Jewish nation, or Israel today is a Jewish nation. So then from that, we can talk about what a nation is. Borders and walls and immigrants. I mean, there's a ways you move from just that one verse and changing that one word to everything that's involved in Christian nationalism.
It's interesting with the prosperity gospel, because there are a lot of people who come to me, and I sometimes work with people, do counseling with people pro bono or for very low fee after they were involved in something that touted the prosperity gospel. So they had to give over. It's like spiritual multi-level marketing. Pay into it and hope you get something out. And if you don't, somehow that's on you, or that's symbolic of something spiritual, and you need to work on the following, or you need to be more patient, or you need to give more money, or whatever it is. And that's also where it becomes more culty, because everything lands back on you. You're responsible for everything bad, and they're responsible for everything good. It's this dichotomy that's sort of 100% of the time, you know, within these groups. They can make a lot of false promises then too, because of it, because then if it's built into the system that you blame yourself if it doesn't quite pay out. sometimes literally, then they can really say whatever they want. And I think about that with Trump talking about prosperity. That doesn't work well for most people. But I just wonder about that. That doesn't really also get talked about. Like, it's a lovely idea that the more you put into something, the more you get out of it. But the people who are making the money are the people at the top and not the people at the bottom. Again, similar to multi-level marketing. But I think people don't want to hear it. They want to have hope.
Yeah, they want to be part of something bigger than themselves. I think we all want to do that. I mean, MAGA is that. You personally may not benefit, or maybe you convince yourself that you can benefit in certain ways from that, but you're part of this larger movement. I mean, this religion up and down, both good and bad, the seven mountains is part of that. I think also that with prosperity gospel, if you think about it again, as an individual message, you personally will be blessed by God if you do X, Y, Z. To nationalize that message is what the seven mountains is about. It's not necessarily taking the individual prosperity gospel message. It is making prosperity gospel a nationalized message. That's what Trump is. You can be like me if you do X, Y, and Z. And even if you fail, I'm still the example for everybody else. And some people will be successful. I mean, the entrepreneur spirit that some of them survive and some of them don't is part of the prosperity gospel. Where the prosperity gospel works in the seven mountains is this idea that you should raise a lot of money, not raise, but when you get a lot of money, when you're successful, you should give that money to God because God gave it to you in the first place. So convincing really rich people to fund your Christian nationalism was part of the original plan of the seven mountains, that you had to convince those really rich people, not just to give you money, but that they were part of a movement larger than themselves to build a legacy, to build a change. And that you were successful in the business area, but now you have all these other mountains in which to be successful in. That was the idea behind the prosperity gospel. You were successful in this one area, and you can be successful in God's area.
Even going back to the use of language here, that you need to give your money to God. You can't speak for God. But God, I'm assuming, would say, I don't need your cash. I'm good. Whatever. Buy food for yourself. There are things I created for you to be able to use. Go get things for you and your family. But just that it's not that you're giving your money to this guy so he could buy his third private jet. You're giving it to God. But really? So that kind of language, I think, keeps people's blinders on about whose pockets it's actually going into.
Obviously, there's a lot of corruption going on in our government, particularly people that use their government roles to raise money on the side. And they're doing that mainly because they can get away with it. But also the idea is that when you believe in a God who blesses people financially, you're just not there yet. You haven't gotten it, whether you fail or not, but it still could happen. As you mentioned, hope. That's not that far of a step to the basic idea of the American dream, that if we just do X, Y, and Z, eventually we'll own a home and we will do this, blah, blah, blah. And you can see just the rhetorical linkage between the two allows the religious part to move into the nationalism part and create a culture-wide idea. Adherents or supporters of this thing, they're not theological experts. They're not people that have multiple degrees. In fact, they're often anti-education. They have these cultural vibes that if I see this one thing over here and see it in another part of culture, then that's a God thing. That I get blessed financially in my business and I'm good at church. That's the God thing. It doesn't take that much to connect the dots for these people. And of course, that's why I write about in one of the chapters that conspiracy is often the method of spreading this idea that you are being conspired against, which is the basic of the mandate itself. These mountains are taken over by anti-Christian forces, but that conspiracies are mounting against you individually and against our institutions, and you should gather with us to undo them.
I think also about how if people are taught to send money in to oftentimes people who already have a lot of money, then they're not able to help their fellow man, so to speak, like donating to a local cause. They're sending their resources into a place that may or may not be doing responsible things with their money and may or may not be really needing their money. And they could be walking past all of the people in their periphery who really could use those resources because they think by sending it to some place, it's going to have this more grand impact.
Global effect. I mean, yeah, that's the idea behind funding missionaries. I'm not against funding missionaries, but the idea is you send your money to the most difficult places, to the places that need the gospel the most, not down the street, but in these other countries. And that was the basis for, again, missionary zeal for some decades. I think what the Seven Mountains Mandate is saying is that not just we need to bring it back home to America, but that we need to pay attention to these institutions in our own culture. Now, the Seven Mountains Mandate is not just an American thing. It is a global thing. There are plenty of church leaders and church prophets and church apostles in different parts of the globe that follow this, mainly because of the prosperity gospel angle. But they're doing the same thing by sending their money to other places. The raising of the stakes from it's a country with bad institutions to it's a globe with bad institutions, that you can see the conspiracy keeps getting higher and higher. And the reason I keep mentioning the raising of the stakes is like, where does this go from here? We keep raising the stakes of conspiratorial, the Jews in control of everything, this global cabal. How much more can we sustain that type of conspiracy when we keep dividing us between people that believe in it and people that don't? Used to be that individuals were bad and there were bad people on the other side. Now it's the entire party is bad. Now it's half the nation is bad. We keep raising the stakes to groups of people that are dark and conspiratorial and evil. I don't know how much more we can raise the stakes of that.
I want to make sure in our conversation we get to the crystal ball part of the conversation, sort of where you see this potentially going, and also what people can do. And just, I think, things like this, getting the word out, letting people know what's happening and how big it is really important. I just remembered something that happened years ago as I was telling you the story about people saying they're helping their fellow man by sending their money to some person who might not need it and might not do appropriate things with it. There was someone who I was friendly with when I was young who became more New Age spiritual in her belief as an adult, which is neither here nor there. You can do that. But I actually had a hard time remaining friends with her after the following happened, that we were supposed to get together and have a reunion. We hadn't seen each other for many years. And I didn't realize how far into her teachings she had become and how much we were not going to have in common after seeing each other. She needed to delay our lunch because she was still meditating. She meditated for a few hours every day, and she was still kind of in the mode. And so she had her partner call me and say, can you delay it by an hour? Fine. A little annoyed, like, okay, fine. But we got together, and then we're walking around. This is in New York. We're walking around, and there was a veteran who was homeless and was hungry and was asking for food or for water or for money. She turned to him and said, sweetheart, I've already helped you more than you can imagine. I just spent 3 hours meditating to raise your vibration. And he looked at her like she was off a rocker. Like, what does that mean? He just said, but I'm hungry. He didn't know what she's talking about. Oh, no, no, but I'm helping you have something where you can be of a higher plane where you won't need food in the same way. You won't suffer in the same way. You won't feel it in the same way. He just wanted water and like a sandwich. But she really felt that through her work, she had done something on a grander scale. But what she missed out on was the human part of it. He really needed something that she thought she had given him by giving to something almost feels like imaginary, similar to sending your check to whomever. It's a very interesting thing. There are a lot of people who think they're doing a lot of good or think they're supporting a lot of good, but they're missing what's happening right around them.
And toward the question of what the future holds or what happens, we think about the political divisions in our country. We think of people in our community or neighbors and things like that, and they already have these set categories of people, right? Liberals, leftists, whatever, and may not think that there are people down the street that do that. But once they learn that there are actual individuals down the street that are off, that are against or disagree with them, they don't often put them in that category. Once you meet them, it's like, oh, you're not like what I thought they were like or something along those lines. That does happen. That's happening less and less. Even in local places, we are not talking, we're not meeting. And so with the Seven Mountains Mandate, groups and Christian nationalism, they constantly recreate or bring up again these shadowy groups, whether they're the left, the far left, or some other things like that. You constantly need a villain. You constantly need these groups of people to suggest that they're controlling everything or they're stopping you from being successful or they're indoctrinating your children. And to go back to your story, it seems that that's what that person was doing, trying to stop the evilness from hurting this one person by meditating them. And they saw that that was the moment in which they should say that, that there are these larger things that should be dealt with, but that when you take the person out of it, you essentialize them into a group. What you're really doing, of course, is suggesting that they're not human, that they're not there right in front of you. I mean, talk about War II, this is what happened during that time. So the Seven Mountains Mandate and Christian nationalism often work through these vague notions of group of people and that they are working at these different institutions and you should work at these different institutions. And I think that it's a very anti-intellectual, anti-education thing, but also it gives people a lot of, ironically, a lot of certainty that this is the group that all our troubles are based upon. Even though it's a vague group, back to prosperity gospel, if you can name it, then you can deal with it.
Here, as we're coming to almost the end of our time talking, and there's so much to talk about, I always want to make sure that people who I'm speaking with have a chance to say what they wanted to make sure to say when we were talking today, and if there's some lessons to be learned, but also what people can do if they're noticing that they're feeling that encroachment within a school system or media, entertainment, all of it that you mentioned.
Again, the central character, if you will, in this book is a group called Turning Point USA, which was founded by Charlie Kirk, who was assassinated on September the 10th. And they're starting these high school and college groups, and they have community groups and coalitions around. It's a large movement. And I'm not directing just action steps against them, but you would see them first if you saw them or saw this movement working. The Christian nationalism strategy of the Seven Mountains is a minority movement on purpose. So to me, the only answer then is a majority movement, is the rest of us getting together and suggesting that we're going to outwork them, outvote them, outplace them. They believe that they could, with their minority status, take over the culture if they do X, Y, and Z. As a majority movement, as people who have allies left and right who may not agree on everything, but we believe then that we are the majority, there are ways in which to work with that in mind. One, of course, you know, debunking, fact-checking, things like that can work with some people. But also, I think it is about pronouncing, describing, putting forth a positive idea of what an American culture should look like. It is not just against this bad stuff, but it has to be a positive declaration, perhaps in response to, but it can't just be an anti thing. I am not an expert in political science or anything like that, but the idea is it could work in communities. We've seen that in recent weeks. It could work nationally in terms of what we want from our democracy and what we want from religious liberty and things like that. But also it has to include the individual. We cannot ignore these people. This mandate's been around for 50 years and it's been gaining steam. As I mentioned, 30 to 40% of Americans believe in it. And I think that the more we ignore them, the more that they will see or feel that they are persecuted and threatened, and the more that they will continue on down this road. You can't save them all, I don't think, but the idea is that somehow we have to include them back into our majority group. And that is going to be a difficult process even after Trump leaves the scene.
And what will make it a difficult process? I mean, I'm thinking psychologically, I could see why that would be hard, but what would make it difficult?
One, they're going to still feel persecuted and disliked, the rest of us. But also, I think that with your cult analogy, their house of cards is falling, perhaps quicker and more powerful than people that leave it in a good way, if you want to say that. So we have to be there. At some point, there have been many stories of people who left MAGA cults and left that kind of thing. And that's kind of an anecdotal one by one. There's going to be a lot of people, perhaps, that after, I don't know, when this is over, say, I didn't really want to be a part of that. And if we continue to suggest that I told you so, or I knew that, or whatever, it's just not going to work. I think it has something to do with religion. If you think about conversion and deconversion, people leaving the church and then coming back and things like that, the people that welcome them back, welcome them in a certain way. There's a lot of repentance, certainly, that could happen, but it would be difficult for both sides to say, welcome back in, yeah, if that makes any sense.
Interesting. I think about people who have left organizations where they were ultimately taken advantage of, or they left a relationship where everyone else could say and could see who that person was really with, and that it was not going to be good. It wasn't going to end well, and it didn't end well. And so there's the worry about saving face and about shame, and that people will sometimes dig their heels in if they think that they're going to be mocked or put down. There's a man I worked with, a young man who left a group and said, well, I sort of prepared his family for how to welcome him back. They were so excited to have him back, but I said, don't have balloons falling from the ceiling. He's not ready to party. He's still like landing. He's still trying to figure out what happened. And he said one of the best things that happened to him was that no one asked questions. Everyone just talked as though nothing had happened. That was lovely. He didn't have to hide out. He didn't have to go back on point just to feel strong and feel on top of his game. And we can push people into those corners without realizing that we're doing that.
I think that's where the cult analogy and the political analogy don't necessarily line up. I mean, I think that individuals certainly leave and we should not judge them, but they're going to hold on to political beliefs perhaps longer than they would cult beliefs. And they're going to hold grudges. They're going to see individual candidates as bad or good, or depending on how they come out. That is, if we want people to participate in our democracy, then we have to ask them to participate in ways that they feel comfortable doing. What I'm getting at is that where the Seven Mountains goes from here, they constantly suggest, of course, that the stakes are being raised, that the final battle is happening, that we should elect this person to finally get what we want. Well, they're never going to get that. And at some point, many of them are going to realize that. What do they turn to at that point? What are we offering them that is not just an anti-version of what they left?
So I'm even thinking about the term final battle. So many organizations, I'm thinking even Jehovah's Witnesses, made a lot from people, had people sign over property to them because they said, you know, the end times are nigh. Everything was fine. Those dates passed. And sometimes they would lose members, but others would stay. But still, I don't know how often they still do it, because they might have learned their lesson to not do it so often, to predict the world was going to be ending. A lot of groups will do that. A lot of cultic groups will do that. But just this idea that there is a final battle, we've heard that many times. So far, so good. But also this idea of it being final, so that people feel this sense of there's a rush to make sure, there's a push, there's a worry about time, and people will get very forceful in their messaging because of it. But also just the term battle. There's something so warlike, even just thinking about evil or anti. And so what can we learn about that sort of rhetoric, the militaristic rhetoric? It's not just, do I agree, do I disagree, but who is good and who is bad? Who's a threat?
So in the book I wrote about evil, the thesis, the argument was, not just there's evil in our language, but the response to that. We have a responsibility to language, to keep it open, to keep words not solidified, not frozen, not essentialized, that we should be able to use them in many different ways. And I think that that's what you're getting at in terms of final battle. We keep raising the stakes of the politics and the religion and the culture we live in, the cultural war that we're having, that we call it a war, that we use these physical descriptions for things that are cultural or spiritual or relational, and that will lead to physical violence, as we have seen. So one, people talk about backing down or cutting down the rhetoric. I think that one particular way is we have a responsibility to language to keep it open, not closed. And what I mean by that, of course, is not using essentialized terms like war and battle, things like that. But also, I think that we have to give up our control of language. And that was sort of the idea of the evil in our language, is that we individually want to control the words that we use. We want them to mean what we want them to mean. And even if you agree with us, we still have that control. And when you try to change it, that's when we have a problem, whether individual arguments or nationalized debates. In a democracy, that doesn't work. we can probably agree on some terms and some essentialized terms, but the idea that all words are controlled by the person who speaks them is not going to happen. And I think that we have to learn ways in which to practice with language that does not limit the other person's ability to also practice with language.
I love that idea. So I'm curious about expanding on that and what that means and how that would change things. I'm thinking also of an author I think of very often when I talk to people, George Orwell. And I'm thinking about his idea about how a lie that's repeated becomes truth. And so just to be cautious about how often you start to agree with something just because you've heard it so often, or how often you side one way or another because it riles you up or makes you anxious, makes you nervous, makes you feel like you need to believe this or else, that suddenly your heart is racing. And I don't know if people know that it was the purposeful use of language that created that sense, that urgency and fear. Keeping language open rather than closed, I love that idea. How would that change the landscape? Like if we were to talk about things in a healthier way, what could it sound like?
The cliche of room for disagreement does work here. What we're disagreeing upon is the meaning or definitions or labels or names we use for things. It does not just have to be this thing. What it would look like practically is that we admit that we are all doing this thing, which is using evil in our language or phrasing or naming things. We all have this power. There's no person using language for good and not evil. We all do this. If we all can admit that, then we're getting at this idea that language is not this succinct system where we have a dictionary and we have definitions and we use them. It is a community effort to define things. And of course, there are boundaries to communities and there are boundaries that are gray. But the idea is that in a democracy, you have to work with your fellow community member on this. It is not authoritarian. It's not top down. It is not the sole purpose of the sacred religious texts. There are people in the community that don't follow that. So ending on the democratic, small d democratic versus the authoritarian works in religion as it does in politics. So keeping language open means in some manners that we all give up our own authoritarianness.
That we all give that up. I could see that being a lot easier for some than for others.
Well, if we all admit that we're doing it, yes. More people have gotten used to doing it, so yes. I'm not suggesting that I am a healthy user of that at all, though.
So if I could motivate people to be open to that, they say that the healthier mind is the more flexible mind. But I think that comes from a certain place of what I call quiet confidence, that you are able to say, maybe yes, maybe no. I'm willing to look and willing to shift and I want to be able to dialogue about this. I don't need to be righter than thou, as I sometimes say. But that is harder for some.
If we think about community and democracy, it is that all people play a role and all people get to vote or anything along those lines. But that also means that at the level of the word, they each should put their own energy or living into that word. The logos is not just one person in this case. It is the thing that brings us all together.
I love that notion. And I think also when I talk about it being harder for some, I think it also depends upon the subject, that for some people, they really do feel that they are saving you and they can't not, because it would be wrong of them to not take this opportunity to tell you that you're wrong, because they think that they're helping. So it can come from a good place, but that urgency is usually fear-based, I think. And is the fear real?
They're going to be judged in heaven for not doing it right.
Exactly. Oh my goodness. So much pressure. As we finish up, tell people where to find you if they want to be in touch with you, where they can find your book and anything else.
I'm on the social media and all the websites, Twitter and Blue Sky. I have a Substack now where I follow Turning Point USA in different ways on a newsletter. It comes out weekly. I have a website called Matthew Boedy, BOEDY.com. If you want to read more about my work there, you can, but those are the ways to find me.
Nice. This is a really, really great and important conversation. And thank you so much. And thank you so much for all the research that you did to put together your book and that you are a presence out there and that you're tracking what's happening in real time, which is really invaluable. Thank you so much for today.
Happy to be here.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Matthew for sharing some really timely and disturbing, sobering, and important information with us today. There is a lot that we talked about, a lot that we covered, this whole militaristic way of talking about things, this idea of a final battle, the idea that somehow there is this war that we are involved in between good and evil, people who are Christian versus people who are somehow anti-Christian, if they're not Christian, really dividing the world into these black and white spaces. And it's not the way people need to operate. It's not the way the world needs to be run, but it is what draws people into groups. It is what makes people adhere to certain kinds of philosophies and theologies, because they feel like if it's not this way, then it's the other way. And the other way is awful or evil, bad, or we're going to die. It, to me, has the markings of it being, for lack of a better term, kind of immature. When you are young and you are playing with your plastic war toys and you have one army fighting with the other army, or you have one group of friends on the playground competing with the other group of friends on the playground, one group wins, the other group loses. One hopes that as people get older and more mature, they don't actually have to think about the world in that way. But there are some people who need to do that in order to drive their point home. They need to do it in order to make sure that they have followers. They need to do it where they get people to believe in their messaging because they really believe somewhere because of their own either paranoia or their teachings that something terrible is going to happen unless everyone believes the same way, unless everyone adheres to the same rules or the same theology. We also talked about indoctrination, which of course I care about deeply. And we talked about talking points and how there are some that really stick and there's some that might not be as sticky as the others. And so I wanted to go over a couple of different strategies that people who do indoctrination usually adhere to so that they make sure that their message really targets as many people as possible and has a hold on these people as much as possible. The first is this idea of the big lie, sort of a large emotionally charged claim that's repeated so often that people stop evaluating it and begin to experience it as common knowledge. People will assume that something repeated over and over is somehow based in reality. It doesn't actually mean that at all. But the brain eventually substitutes familiarity with verification. I'll say that again. The brain eventually substitutes familiarity for verification. It likes to repeat the things or connect to the things that feel familiar, that feel like lines, phrases, beliefs you've heard before. And the comfort of the familiarity is something that the brain enjoys. But it does that in lieu of asking if what you're being told to say or to believe is actually true. Examples of this is the outside world is dangerous and corrupt, or everyone who leaves this group or this philosophy or theology becomes miserable or is destroyed, or the media is lying to you about us, so you can't trust what you're hearing in the news about us. Things are somehow a lie. You need to then be with us in order to keep yourself safe and to know the quote-unquote truth, even though the truth never really gets verified. It's just presented as something called the truth. Then there's the kernel of truth explanation, which is a statement that begins with something plausible or factual, but extends into an exaggerated or false conclusion. So what happens is that this is unfortunately very successful because people lower their skepticism about things when the opening, when the beginning of the idea feels accurate. Oh, okay. I have a buy-in for the first part of that sentence, so I guess the second part of that sentence might also be true. So the true element anchors the rest of the claim. So let's say we say many institutions have failed people, which is true. Then the false claim after the comma is, therefore, you can't trust any outside authority. Or families sometimes misunderstand your spiritual path. That's true. And families who question the groups are trying to sabotage your growth and don't care about you and don't truly love you and you can't truly trust them. So you buy into the first part and then they can take you on this journey to the next part, which is a huge exaggeration and often false. And then there's the fear and protection messaging. There's a repeated warning about danger, and it's paired with a claim that only the leader or the person you're with or this ideology or the group can provide you with safety. When something is presented with fear, as we've talked about a little bit on the podcast, it heightens your attention to it and it increases the chance that you're going to remember it. That's for your safety because you think if there's something that could cause me danger, I need to remember what it is. People then, if they believe in this message or wonder if maybe it's true or not, they'll gravitate towards whoever appears to offer them protection from this, still not questioning if there's even a this, if there's anything they need to be worried about. So these are the people who are going to believe messages like the world is collapsing morally across the board and we need to save it. Enemies are trying to destroy our movement. If you leave, terrible things will happen to you. It also creates dependency, of course, because then you feel dependent on this authority figure who says they'll keep you safe from all of these supposed horrible things. And then you have this identity and specialness messaging. So members are repeatedly told they're unique or chosen, enlightened, morally superior. Of course, they're often put down and criticized. And so there's sort of a roller coaster of being propped up in this very special way and then being pushed down. But the identity and specialness messaging works because people strongly protect beliefs tied to their identity, tied to things that make them feel good and strong and special. And it also creates some emotional investment in the group because it's making you feel good to believe these things. So you then feel emotionally connected to this group for providing you with that feeling. Like you are part of the only group that understands the truth. You're more spiritually evolved than other people. Others are asleep and you're awake. All of these ideas. And then we have, as we've talked about through Robert J. Lifton, the thought-terminating cliches. So soft phrases are repeated to shut down critical thinking or uncomfortable questions. This works very well. Simple slogans replace complex thinking, complex reflection, complex investigation. Repetition also makes the phrase feel like an answer when it isn't, because it becomes automatic. If I don't understand what's going on, the group will say, trust the process. Or if I'm just doubting that this is going to work, there's the phrase, doubt is your ego talking. And if you say, I don't understand because it's actually not understandable or it doesn't make the slightest bit of sense, then you might hear this thought terminating cliche. Well, if you don't understand, that means you're not ready or you're not opening your heart or you're not opening the channels of understanding inside of you. And we can help you with that. It is really important to know that all of these techniques are being used on you in so many ways. And you want to be able to decipher. You want to be able to get to the root. You want to be able to still ask questions. Yeah, but what is this thing that I am taking on as my new truth? Where is the evidence? And let me move out of my sphere of influence. Let me take the risk of talking to people who feel differently. Let me take the risk of going to websites that are not ones that are just fed to me through my algorithm online, and find out what other people say and what other people think, and be open to it. Thank you so much to Matthew for coming on today to tell us about something that I think is important to know, and I think is at the height of respectfulness for the population to let them know what's happening as an undercurrent when they're not watching, but that it's something that's going to affect them deeply at some point. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us @@_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.